Hello, and welcome to the Tech CEO Essentials Podcast. We're focused on the top areas tech CEOs need to know. I'm your host, Tom Cooper, and this podcast is sponsored by my company, Bright Hill Group, where we help leaders get more from their teams. Does your current leadership team have a shared, laser-like focus on a small, clear set of objectives? Do you have young leaders who will be ready to step into leadership roles as soon as you need them? At Bright Hill Group, we can help you focus on what's wildly important and help you prepare your young leaders to be ready to step up when you need them. Give us a call. Today's topic is sales essentials. What exactly does a tech CEO need to know about sales to really grow the company? And today, I'm talking with Ian Altman from Grow My Revenue. Now, before Ian founded Grow My Revenue, he served as CEO of technology and professional services companies for 2 decades before selling them. He then served as managing director of a parent company that he grew from $100 million in revenue to $2 billion in just 3 years. Ian's also the author of Upside Down Selling, an Amazon number one bestseller. His book helps audiences discover how to flip the sales process upside down to become outrageously successful in targeting and winning business. Now, Ian's work is published regularly on the Huffington Post and the Washington Business Journal, and you can find his stuff at growmyrevenue.com. Ian, welcome.
Tom, great to be here.
So let's jump right in. What is the biggest mistake you see tech CEOs and teams make about selling?
Well, Tom, what it comes down to is this, and this, it's a very common thing, which is, especially in technology, we all fall in love with the technology that we're selling. So we become masters of what it is that we have. The challenge there is that the way customers buy is they don't care what you have. All they care is why they need it. And I have the benefit of speaking with many CEO organizations, peer networking groups and things like that, and I do an exercise with them that talks about how they make purchase decisions. And it comes down to, for them, a matter of anytime they're looking to buy something, what they want to know is, why do I need it? What's the likely outcome or result that I'm going to achieve from that? And then why should I buy it from you? And so when we're talking about the features and the capabilities of our technology and not recognizing the problem that we solve, it's very easy for the customer to get confused. Even though we're in love with our technology, they don't necessarily know why they need it.
Now, hang on a sec. I'm going to have to jump in here because what you're telling me is that it's not obvious to the customer why the features and benefits are going to solve their problem?
You know what? Strangely not. I mean, the thing is that, and remember, I ran software and technology companies. So we had technology that we absolutely loved, that we thought was the coolest thing ever. It wasn't until we created the connection between why someone would need that and then give them the ability to buy it, that's when we started to achieve great success. So this idea is that we naturally assume that when someone sees some great feature, that they're going to understand why they need it. And the reality is they're living in a different world. And so what seems obvious to us isn't always obvious to the customer.
So, but traditionally we think in terms of features and benefits. How can I brag about how great my product is and what you're going to get from it? And you're saying that focus is really the wrong focus, that we should be looking at problems instead?
Yeah, it's absolutely right, Tom. In fact, let me phrase it this way. If I asked you to give me the textbook definition of an elevator pitch, what would you describe an elevator pitch as?
Well, it's going to be the 30-second definition of what I do and how powerful it is.
Exactly. And so what we do is I flip that on its head, and we'll use a term called the elevator rant. And the elevator rant basically is, what is it that your client or prospect would be complaining about? It could be their complaints about an existing vendor. It could be their complaints about something going on in their current business. That if you overheard it as the CEO, you'd say, man, we're the best people on the planet to fix that problem. If you start thinking in terms of that, in terms of here's the problem that we're really good at solving, what happens is instead of calling somebody up and saying, hey, Tom, I want to come out and show you a demo of this technology that we have. Instead, I call you up and say, you know what, Tom, people come to us when they have one of these two or three major problems. And we find that we're really effective at solving that for about half the people we talk to. Not yet sure I know enough about your situation to know whether or not I can help you, but I'd be happy to come out and talk to you and see whether or not we might be able to help. it changes the dynamic. So now the customer is convincing you that they've got a problem worth solving instead of you trying to get someone else to fall in love with what you created. Because guess what? You know, we all love our own children, but we're never going to get someone else to love them as much as we do.
So, all right, can you flesh that out a little bit? Can you tell a story or give us an example of something that would help crystallize that?
Absolutely. So let me give you an example of something that probably most of us have been on the receiving end of, which is, and I want to take it out of technology and think of it more from the perspective of, let's say you're on the receiving end of a call from someone trying to sell insurance benefits. So the insurance benefits broker calls up and says, "Hey, Tom, you know, we're a great insurance benefits broker, really care about our clients. We take the time to listen to people. You know, we're looking out for your interest," all these things that I'm sure no one else has ever said. and so they call up, and those people get about a 1% response rate. Mm-hmm. So a client of mine, we said, "Well, what's the elevator rant that your clients have?" And he said, "Well, most of, you know, our ideal client is spending about $1 million a year right now in insurance benefits, and over the next 7 years, that number is going to double to 2 million. I said, "Okay." The message that we came up with from a prospecting standpoint sounds like this. So they would call you up as someone they know is spending $1 million a year on their benefits and say, "Tom, we work with companies who are currently spending $1 million in benefits. And they know that left unchecked, that's going to go to 2 million over the next 7 years, which translates to another $3.5 million out of your pocket that most people tell us they'd rather have for other purposes." Now, we find we could have a dramatic impact on about half the people that we speak with, but if solving that $3.5 million issue is important to you, we'd be happy to come out and talk to you and see whether or not we might be able to help. And their response rate went from less than 1% to about 30%.
Wow.
They're still selling the same thing. In the technology space, it works the same way. There's a company that I profile on Upside Down Selling called Accela Consulting. They're an IT consulting shop. And they used to say, "Oh, yeah, we do agile development and we do complex database design and things like that, that people would just slip into a coma when they started hearing about it." and now what they say to people is, "Look, people come to us if they've tried to implement technology multiple times and it's still not doing what the users need. Or they keep missing deadlines. It keeps taking too long and they're frustrated having spent money before. We're not the least expensive. It's just people come to us when this time is the last time they want to do it." Hmm. And the funny part is that you would think, okay, geez, that message really resonate. Well, these guys more than doubled their growth rate in the next year, and they did it while pursuing fewer opportunities than they had in the past.
Interesting. Interesting. So by focusing on what it is that the customer is going to complain about, the things that he's feeling pain about or frustrated about, and then saying, "We help solve that problem," it turns it to the upside down perspective.
Exactly. And the big question you have to ask yourself is this: on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that someone would spend money to solve that issue? Because if you come up with an elevator rant that someone feels, you know, 1 to 10 they would solve at a 5, most of us don't spend money to solve a 5, but we spend money when it's an 8, 9, or 10. So it has to be pretty compelling to catch someone's attention. Now, the fear that some people have is, "Well, if I just focus on that, I might miss opportunities." And the answer is, that's correct. You're going to miss the opportunities of the people who weren't going to spend money anyhow. Hmm. But if we identify people who have a problem that they feel is worth solving, well, man, we got their attention. And at that point, we're not talking about us, we're talking about them. And that's most people's favorite topic. They love talking about themselves. And the greatest single differentiator you can have, and this sounds bizarre, it's not the features, it's not the capabilities of your product. When that client feels that you have a better understanding of their situation than anyone else, you win. And you can only do that by engaging in a conversation where you're asking them questions.
So let me dig in on that question of the pain level that goes along with a rant. So how do you assess whether something is a 5 or a 7?
The idea is that in most cases, it's as simple as asking. Hmm. So it might sound something like, "So, gee, Tom, you know, 1 to 10, how important is that to you compared to other things on your plate right now?" Now, initially, when you're coming up with these ideas, all you can really do is test the message with people who are representative of your audience.
Right.
So the idea is that it might literally be something as simple as you come up with a few messages and you go to your existing clients and say, hey, we're thinking about talking to people about this. How important is that to people to solve? You can also go to your existing clients and say, what was really so compelling your business that, you know, pushed you over the edge to engage us to help you? And they'll often tell you, and it's usually not what you think it is.
Hmm. So, all right, so that's a whole other area now, right? You're looking at why do people buy, and surely people buy because I've got the best features, I've got the best benefits, we've got the best relationship, whatever that is. We really care about our customers, we listen to our customers, and you're saying that might not have anything to do with why somebody bought from me.
In fact, I would go so far as to say it has very little to do. It's how we rationalize it as business leaders. We think it's because, wow, we should have, we have the best features, we have the best capabilities, but they don't care about that. They only care about what's in it for me, meaning how are you addressing a need that I have? So if you've got great capabilities for a problem I don't have, then I don't even care. But if you if you're someone who in general has a mediocre product, but the three things it does well happen to align with the three things I really need, then the guy with the better solution might lose. So if you've ever been in a situation as a technology CEO where you lost to what you felt was an inferior product, it's probably because the customer felt that that other vendor had a better understanding of their situation and specifically could address their issues better than you could, even though you had 100 features that they didn't care about.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think you're digging into an area where it's obvious to those of us in our industry that we're superior to our competition for whatever reason, but it's not obvious to the customer. And I've definitely seen that challenge thrown up. Why would they buy from those people? Those people are idiots. They don't have any idea how to solve these problems. And you're saying that it's probable that those people who we tend to think of as being less competent may actually be more effective at connecting with the pain that the customer is feeling.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, it's a matter of the customers buy from the people they feel best understand their situation. There's an exercise I've done with over 1,000 CEOs that says to them, look, all things being equal, who are you most likely to buy from? One of the options is the least expensive. The another option is the person who best understands your situation. The next one is the one with the greatest features or capabilities. And the next one is the person who you like the best. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that almost 100%, and I say this because there are two instances where I didn't get this answer, in all but two situations in over 1,000 people, the answer is the people who best understands my situation. And the only two exceptions, one was someone said, well, I don't want you to be able to say that everyone always gives this answer, so I'm just arbitrarily I'm arbitrarily picking another one. And then someone else gave a different answer, and I said, well, that's interesting. Why'd you give that? And he said, well, actually, I don't know that I really understood the question. Maybe I'd go with a different one, but in the interest of full disclosure, I don't count that one as best understands my situation. But so across 1,000 people, let's just say that it's pretty close to 100% say the organization that best understands my situation.
Interesting. That is really interesting. Now, frequently in a sales discussion, price is a big deal.
Yep.
And it seems like that's something we get stuck on. So how do you overcome price?
Well, the price really is a balance between value and price. What I mean by that is that left with nothing to compare it to, price always seems high. And so there's a story that I tell when I was, before I started my businesses, I worked for a company that sold mainframe-based technologies. And I had a client call me up. This is the largest commercial client we had. Said, look, we've got 300 images we need to put up online. Engineering comes back and tells me, yep, it's going to cost about $1,000 per image to put the 300 images up. Almost universally, everyone says, oh, you're in trouble. There's no way anyone's going to pay for that. Well, as the story goes on, what happens is I end up with a discussion with the client, And I asked the client, I said, well, so why is it, again, you guys are doing this? And it wasn't because I understood this principle that I'm sharing with you now. It was just because I was trying to stall. And this guy, Steve, says, oh, I don't think we talked about it. See, our competitors overseas all have gone to a PC-based system, so they deliver these schematic diagrams electronically. We're still distributing them in paper, which means by the time we print them, distribute them, and then our reps go out and insert them into the notebooks at each store, there's about a three-week delay. And during those 3 weeks, we've determined that we're losing about $30 million a quarter in lost sales. Well, in the context of $30 million in lost sales a quarter, $300,000 is a drop in the bucket. And so the thing is this, that we tend to always focus on the issue. I use an iceberg metaphor. So the issue is the tip of the iceberg. What we really have to look at is we have to go beyond the issue and get to the impact and relative importance of solving that problem to the client. And that's how we overcome price. Because I will tell you that I would not have been very confident presenting a $300,000 number when I didn't know what the impact was to their organization. But once they said, oh, yeah, we're losing $30 million a quarter, I was very confident in presenting a $500,000 number.
Right.
Now, if you're doing the math, you're saying, Ian, 300 times 1,000 is 300,000. You know, today, maybe I would have sold it for $3 million, but at the time, a $500,000 seemed like a better deal than 300,000. But it's that whole level of what I call issue impact importance that says, how do you go beyond the issue? And how do you get the customer to convince you, not you convince them, how do you get the customer to convince you that their issue has enough impact on their business and is important enough to solve to make it worth your time to solve it?
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, I think you put yourself in a position where you really begin to understand the context of the decision-making process. I worked for a company for a while that was selling solutions that absolutely saved customers millions of dollars. The problem was that customers were facing problems that cost them tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So it wasn't that the solution that we were offering was not valid. It just wasn't in the scheme of things, you know, on the importance level. It was a three or a four instead of an eight or a nine.
Yep, exactly. And so the idea is, once I got to that, I mean, this guy said, look, it's costing us $30 million a quarter. And if I don't find a solution to this thing in a hurry, I'm going to be looking for a new job. So I knew it was, not only was it impactful, but it was really important for him to solve, which gives you that confidence. Price matters most when we think it matters most. And I've written a fair amount about this, but this whole notion of oftentimes when you discount, you actually decrease your likelihood of closing the business rather than increase it, which sounds counterintuitive. But think about it. If I told you, hey, Tom, I've got this thing, it's $1,000. And now all of a sudden I call you out of the blue and say, hey, Tom, that same thing, I'll let you have it for $600. The first thing going through your mind is, what's wrong with it? And so you actually run the risk of undermining someone's confidence because they assume that, man, maybe he's not as confident in what it is they have. And you can lose to someone else. Now, the customer doesn't tell you, oh, I switched to someone else because you guys were less expensive. The customer says, well, you know, yeah, we just decided to go a different direction. Or, well, we felt someone else better met our needs. And the reality is they just weren't confident in what it is that you were offering.
Interesting. So it sounds like what you're talking about is pretty different from traditional selling, because we're usually speeds and feeds, or features and benefits, and whiz-bang buzzword. So if the sales process is different, does that mean that we should be looking for something different from a sales professional than we would look for as traditionally? What should we be looking for in a salesperson?
You know, I'm glad you asked. In my prior business, and I never really thought of it the same way that I see it today, I would always, when I was interviewing potential salespeople, I was looking for the person who came in, was gregarious, built rapport quickly, backslapping, you know, fun type of person. They measure introversion, extroversion on a scale from 1 to 7, where 4 is right in the middle, 7 is the extreme extrovert who basically wants to be at a party with 1,000 people, but that's not enough. They want to be the center of attention, and the 1 is the person who would just assume be reading a book alone at home in the dark. They don't even want their neighbors to be home. So that would be the extremes of 1 to 7. And I was typically looking for the people that were around 6 or 7. And the Adam Grant at Wharton did an interesting study on this where they try to find the correlation between introversion or extroversion and effective sales. And the people who were sixes and sevens performed just about the same as the people who were at ones and twos. Hmm. And the people who outperformed everybody were right around the middle, or about a four. And they literally performed almost 100% better than the people on the extremes. And there's a lot of different theories into it, but the big message that came through to me was that the people in the middle strike a good balance between listening and talking. So they're not just coming in talking about their stuff. They'll take the time to investigate, but they'll also take the time to let the client be heard. And nowadays, you can get information about a company's products and features online. You don't need the salesperson's the walking brochure. The salesperson's job has now evolved to being one of determining a fit between the client's needs and the services that you offer, because that's the one thing the client can't figure out online on their own.
So how well does my product actually address my prospective customer's pain point?
Exactly. And the only way I can determine that is by asking questions and understanding more about their situation.
So actually listening to customers.
You know what? Listening to customers, but part of it is, you know, for example, if I said to my customer, well, what's your biggest issue? They might give me something I can't address. And that's why the elevator rant becomes so important, because what I want to be able to do is say, here's what we found is important to other people. How does that resonate for you? Mm-hmm. And then you're seen as a subject matter expert, not just somebody who's pitching a ware.
But doesn't that put you in a position where the customer says, yeah, that's not a pain for me?
Absolutely. And guess what? Let's say that you're really good at solving three major pains, and they don't have one of those.
Right.
That's a great opportunity for your competitor to waste a lot of time chasing somebody who's not going to spend money. Because if they don't have the problem, they're not likely to spend money to fix something that isn't broken.
So finding out that something's not an opportunity is a win.
Absolutely. In fact, I would argue that most organizations, especially in technology, it's not that they have a lack of opportunities. It's that they chase so many opportunities with this unabashed optimism that they don't have the right resources to be attuned to the ones where they could have the greatest impact. And so what happens is they end up chasing deals that are never going to happen. And they waste a lot of energy. And when the right deal comes along, they don't have the resources to give those people the proper attention to convert them into a client. So when I talked about these guys at Accela who doubled their growth rate and pursued fewer opportunities, that was the model. They got to know a whole lot faster, meaning NO. They got to know faster, as well as they got to yes for the right opportunities. But they figured out what was the right fit for them, and they focused their effort on those things rather than the deals that are low probability.
Well, that alone can be extremely valuable for a company. Just not going the wrong direction can be really, really valuable.
Oh yeah, it's a tough thing, because of the 100 opportunities that you shouldn't be pursuing, you might close one of them, and it's kind of the kiss of death, because then people say, "Oh, that's a good opportunity for us," and they forget that they wasted more time and money on the 99 they didn't win than they ever made on the one that they landed.
Interesting. It requires a higher level of analysis than we generally put in, right?
Well, it requires a commitment and focus to the deals that are the right deals for you.
So I guess kind of thinking about what we've talked about today, you said the biggest mistake tech CEOs make and the sales teams make is focusing on speeds and feeds or features and benefits instead of thinking about what's the rant or the challenge.
Yep.
Okay. And then the price, we overcome price by?
Overcome price by getting to issue, impact, and importance with our client, getting them to convince us what the impact is of that issue, rather than just focusing on what the issue is, which is the tip of the iceberg.
And you really, I mean, I think kind of at the highest level, what you're talking about is how do we focus our attention on those things that are the biggest win for us so that we don't invest time and effort on things that are not going to close anyway.
Exactly. It's you know, I often say don't play fetch. Don't go chasing, you know, things that have no reward associated with them. You want to ferret that stuff out pretty early in the process.
Wow, this has been great. Thank you so much for digging in and driving us through some of these ideas. I'm excited about it. Now, you've also given us a simple one-page worksheet to help the listeners begin to put some of this into practice. And I appreciate that. That's going to be on the brighthillgroup.com website, so be sure and look for that. Now, later this year, Ian's got a new book coming out. I think it's called Same Side Selling. You co-authored that with Jack Quarles of Buying Excellence.
Correct.
And this new one is focusing on what exactly?
Well, the idea is that so Jack works with companies that are making any sort of purchase that's $500,000 or greater. I obviously work with companies on the sales and business development side, and you would think would be arch rivals or arch enemies. But the reality is we see eye to eye in a lot of these areas. And what we found is that there are these adversarial traps that buyers and sellers fall into where they're not working together. They're working kind of opposed to each other. And this is all about identifying those adversarial traps, and then between us prescribing a path that basically says, here's how you get on the same side of the table with your prospect. And we use the metaphor of a puzzle. It's almost like two people putting a puzzle together rather than a death match or a tank battle. And so that notion of working on the same side will tend to shorten sales cycles, improve margins, and generally create better value for everybody.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm sure that's going to be a huge value add. So be sure and be on the lookout for Same Side Selling coming out very soon. Ian, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Great questions. And obviously, if anyone's got any questions, they can certainly reach out to me. I'm always happy to answer them.
That's great. For more information on Ian, be sure to connect with him on growmyrevenue.com. You can also sign up for his blog entries, which are sometimes irreverent, but certainly insightful, and we appreciate that. So for our listeners, join us next time for more Tech CEO Essentials. It's going to be great. For Bright Hill Group, this is Tom Cooper signing off.